all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We are recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm. You can reach us at 800-693-4800. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today historian and author Megan Corman. Megan, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, we're glad to have you on to talk about this World War II story that you've researched and written about. Your book is The Escape Line, How the Ordinary Heroes of Dutch Paris Resisted the Nazi Occupation of Western Europe. But before we get into the book itself, tell us a little bit about Megan Corman. One does not get born a historian and author. So so tell us how that all got shaped.
Well, I actually blame my uncle, who lived in the Netherlands. My father came to the U.S. when he was a young man, and he had been born just before the war. His brother and sister were quite a bit older, and they were in the resistance in the Dutch city of Maastricht. So when I was five, we went to visit my uncle, and he told me these stories. But he only told me the stories you would tell a five-year-old, and that captured my imagination. So I've always been curious about the resistance, and I've been curious about sort of catastrophe of the Second World War. So I ended up being a rather nerdy kid. I ended up in graduate school. I wanted to study the resistance, but it wasn't possible. The archives didn't exist at that time. So I've studied other aspects of the Second World War, and then when I had this opportunity to actually work on a resistance line, I couldn't resist.
Naturally so, with the family connection. You did your undergraduate at the University of Notre Dame, and I understand you got your PhD in from the University of California at Berkeley?
That's correct.
You mentioned this. I'll jump to this at the moment because it's sort of the setup. It's the work that you did to be able to write about this story. You mentioned the archives. And when you first began looking at this area, the archives of a lot of countries were not available to for historians and researchers to look into. Tell us a little bit about those archives, the different countries involved, and ultimately how you were able to look at the materials, the source materials from which the book sprang out of.
Okay, well, and this goes for the U.S. archives as well, because part of my research was to read escape and evasion reports by American aviators who were, you know, downed over Western Europe and were helped by Dutch Paris to get to Spain so they could get back to their bases. Those escape and evasion reports are now online. Anybody can read them. But 20 years ago, they were still classified. And it would have been possible for a historian to see them, but it would have required quite a bit of rigmarole. In Europe, the Second World War is obviously much more present, and it's still part of living memory. And when I started out as a historian in the late 80s, early 90s, there were a lot of people who had come to power who perhaps had things to hide, or didn't want things brought up. They felt that the country had moved on and we didn't need any muckraking. So the archives, particularly in France, were just closed down. It was very difficult to get any documents for 1939 to 1945. And I'm including reports about the potato crop here, not just, you know, things that would seem more controversial, such as court cases involving collaborators. So when I started out, you had to ask for permission for each document, and the permission had to come from the Ministry of Culture and the National Police Force and the local archivist. And if the local archivist didn't want you to see the catalog, there was no way you could even ask for permission. So, and that would take a few months to get that. Now you can walk into a French archive with a passport, and you can certainly see the potato crops. You can see all sorts of things. You still need special permission to see court cases. The reason that these have changed is the passage of time. A lot of people directly involved have passed on. The younger generation has come into power and wanted to know what their parents were up to, changed the laws. And also, quite a few of the documents that I used were part of the administrations that administered veterans benefits. Because if you were a recognized resistor in Europe, you were entitled to certain benefits for the rest of your life. And that might be going to the front of the line for the bus. It could be medical benefits. It could be all sorts of things. And those were administered through different types of bureaucracies in different countries. Since those, most of their clientele has passed on, they're no longer active bureaucracies, and their files have now become archives. And those archives are being cataloged and opened to researchers.
Well, it's really interesting to sort of hear how one puts this kind of historical story together. Did you also have the opportunity to talk to individuals who were part of the Dutch Paris Resistance?
I did, indeed. I was very honored to be able to speak to just a handful of people who were still living. A man in the Netherlands named Willy Heijmans, who was a medical student during the war and brought many, many people out of the Netherlands into Belgium. He did all sorts of things. He always claimed that he didn't do enough, but he was truly a hero in my view. I spoke to a woman in Switzerland, Anna Zürcher, who hid people in her attic, which could have gotten her killed if she'd been caught. She, again, thought, oh, it was just normal. I didn't do anything. So there were a few people. Most interestingly, I've been able to contact some of the families of these people, or they've contacted me through my blog. And for the most part, it starts out, I'm trying to find out what Uncle Hans did, or my father was probably helped by you. And I could point them, you know, in the direction of archives, or I could say, yes, I did find this name, or no, I did not find this name. So we've been able to have, we had a meeting in Amsterdam in 2016 of what we call Children of Dutch Paris, and people came from Sweden, from France, from the U.S. to meet these other people whose relatives had been part of the resistance line, because it echoes down the generations. So even though they themselves were born after the war was such a big part of their family life, especially if their parents didn't talk about it, that they really felt an immediate connection to these other people whose relatives had been part of Dutch Paris. And we're having another dinner in a couple weeks in California.
Well, I think a lot of people could relate to how the family members feel, because it, you know, but for that action, many of them wouldn't be there. But scope this out for us. Explain to us a little bit about what these ordinary citizens did and how many people they were able to help, and a little bit about how they went about doing this, because it's, in hindsight, it seems so extraordinary.
Well, it is extraordinary. I think if they had realized what they were going to do, they might have decided they wouldn't be able to do it. But essentially, it started out because fugitives, and for the most part, they were Jews who were running from the Nazis, asked for help. And it was, of course, illegal to help a fugitive, whether that person be a Jewish child or an American aviator. So if you said, yes, I will help you, you were breaking the law. You were part of the resistance. If you, there were many ways to help. You could give them money. You could give them a night's shelter. You could hide them indefinitely. Or you could try to get them to safety in Switzerland, which was neutral, or to Spain. The advantage of Spain would be that you could leave Spain and get to England. And then, of course, if you were an Allied soldier or aviator, you'd be back in your base. Or if you were a young civilian man who wanted to volunteer with the Allied armies, you could do that by first getting to Spain. So people asked for help. And these people who became...
Megan?
Yes?
You're breaking up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So
am I back?
Yep, you're back now. I need you to start with talking about the people asked for help. And,
okay.
And I'll edit this out.
Okay. All right. Where in the people asking for help?
So let me go to this. How many people were part of the Dutch Paris resistance?
There were about 330 men and women, a few teenagers. And they were spread across Western Europe.
And there are a lot of borders that have to be crossed to get from, say, the Netherlands to Spain. How did this relay of people go on?
Yes, and there are more borders than you might think because there were occupation zones and you needed different documents within each zone. So you would need different false documents if you were a fugitive. It just happened because people knew each other and sometimes the connection was very tenuous. My third cousin is your hairdresser kind of thing. Or our cousins play field hockey together, something like that. Or somebody who was already part of Dutch Paris needed something. They needed a place to hide people. Or they needed black market food. And they went and they asked a person who had access to what they needed. And that was the way that they would invite people. But it was all person to person. It was all a matter of trust, and often between strangers.
We think of these sorts of resistance efforts as maybe there's one person leading and coordinating it all. Was that the case here?
Well, there is one man who's recognized as the leader, and that's Jean Widener. But he had two lieutenants, if you will, Edmund Chait and Jacques Rennes. But really, Dutch Paris was spread across five countries. So for the most part, people were doing what they thought best. And Widener, Rennes, and Chait would constantly circulate, and they would have meetings and say, okay, what's going on? Do you have a problem? How should we solve it? Do you need money? Here's some money. So, yes, there were leaders, but there was really a lot of self-motivated people.
You mentioned that to cross the various borders and occupied zones, you'd need papers. Was there multiple forgers? Doesn't seem like the right word in this instance, but were there multiple people working on false documents for the fugitives?
Yes, and they were forgers. And you shouldn't forget that although all of these people were very respectable before they joined the resistance, as soon as they agreed to help someone, they became lawbreakers. So they were forgers. And you needed forgers in every area, every occupation zone, because the papers were different. And the paper on which the forms were made were different. And the German stamps were different. So you sort of needed local access to local materials and local information. And this is one of the reasons it took so long to get across Europe, because a fugitive would arrive in an area, have a photograph taken, and have to wait for the false papers to be made for that region.
Now, there's As we change borders, we're also changing languages through this travel on the Dutch-Paris line. Would you have a guide? Would somebody from the resistance take you from point A to point B, or were you simply pointed in a direction, given the papers, and hopefully you got there?
Well, it sort of depended. If they thought that you were a European civilian who spoke French and Dutch well enough and had enough savoir-faire, then they might point you in the right direction. If you were an American aviator, no, they would not let you wander off into, you know, occupied Europe on your own. There were guides. Oftentimes, the guides were sort of hidden. They might be in the same compartment of a train, but not sitting right next to the fugitives. And they came in handy sometimes. There was a case on the Belgian-French border where some Americans had been given a disguise as deaf mutes to hide the fact that they couldn't speak any of the languages involved. And only one time a customs officer challenged the men on this, and the guy, thinking very quickly, got all huffy and started berating this customs officer for being so insensitive and inconsiderate. Couldn't he see this was a deaf mute, and how dare he insult the man like this, and on, and the custom officer backed down and let the American through. And fortunately, the American kept his cool and played along with him.
Again, if you saw this in a movie, I'm not sure you'd believe it.
No, you wouldn't, no. And, you know, don't forget, some Americans spoke other languages. There was a lieutenant on a B-17 crashed. He spoke German because that was his heritage. So they were trying to, again, on the Belgian border, but this time not on the train, they were trying to cross the field, and they had been given some cigarettes to pretend to be cigarette smugglers. So, sure enough, the German, you know, gets them and waves them over and demands to see their papers. And this young lieutenant, who I think was 21, maybe 22 at the time, bluffs his way through in German. And the German guard says, "Oh, okay, well, I'm going to go take these papers to check them out. You come back in 2 hours." Needless to say, they did not come back at all.
Well, it sounded like the German didn't want to do any extra paperwork. So,
right.
So there were about 1,500 Jews who the Dutch Paris Resistance Network hid in France and Belgium, and another 1,500 or so that were escorted to safety in Spain and Switzerland.
Correct.
When you start working with those kind of numbers, you have to ask yourself, how many times did this go wrong?
Well, surprisingly few. It's quite amazing how many times it did work. But there were disasters. There was a case, if we go back to aviators again, in February of 1944, there was a group of 30 aviators and Dutch volunteers going over the Pyrenees. And on a good trip, that was 2 nights walking in the mountains in the dark. This was a bad trip. They started off in the dark. A blizzard came down. None of them had the right equipment. None of them had good shoes. They ended up taking shelter in a shepherd's hut. And when they came out the next morning, they were surrounded by the best of the best Austrian customs patrol on skis. The surprising thing is 15 of them escaped, but 15 were captured. There were also arrests, some of them quite random. Not long after that incident on the border, a Dutch Paris courier was arrested in a cafe in Paris. Just randomly, by a French police unit because she had food with her. The food, she was supposed to
guide some aviators down to Toulouse that night, and she was carrying food that the men would take with them on that trek over the Pyrenees. So she was arrested for black marketeering because she had this extra food beyond her ration. And usually she would have been able to talk her way out of it, but it was a collaborationist unit, and they turned her over to the Germans. And the Germans tortured her, and they threatened her family. And as a British report said, she went to pieces in the Gestapo torture house, and she gave some names and addresses. So what unfolded from that was a lot of arrests. And the Germans arrested more, and they tortured them, and they got more information. And these arrests kept going, even after the Normandy landings, pretty much until the German retreat from the Netherlands and, I'm sorry, from France and from Belgium. So that it turned out that almost everybody involved in the aviator escape line, part of Dutch Paris, was arrested. And many of them were deported to the concentration camps. They did not, however, arrest the leaders of Dutch Paris. And they were able to keep the line going, and particularly keep the support of people in hiding going until they didn't need to hide anymore.
And was the leadership just that segmented from the rest of the participants that they weren't given up in those arrests and torture situations? Was it just luck, or was it by design?
It was by design. The leadership kept themselves deliberately separate because they knew that if they were tortured, everybody would suffer. And nobody thought that they were so strong that they would be able to withstand torture. Some did, but nobody expected to be able to do that. So the leadership traveled differently. They stayed in different houses than everybody else. It was very hard to find them. They appeared when they would appear. And it paid off.
Did the Allies know that, and did the Allies support the Dutch Paris escape line resistance that was going on? Obviously, they were getting their some of their aviators back, so they were aware of the assistance that was being handed out, but were they able to help in any way?
Oh, that's an interesting question, because as you can imagine, this was tremendously expensive. And the people who started it started off using their own money, but they ran out of their own money. So then some of them were businessmen, and they had really creative ways of raising money and exchanging currency and moving it around against the law, et cetera, et cetera. But they needed deep pockets. So they went to the Dutch embassy in Switzerland. And the Dutch government in exile, which was in London, eventually agreed to support Dutch Paris. One of the conditions of supporting Dutch Paris was to bring certain people from the Netherlands to Spain. And then the resistors were allowed to help whoever they wanted in whatever way they thought fit. So the Dutch military attaché in Bern, Switzerland, had a very good relationship with the American military attaché there and the British military attaché there. And those men paid the cost of bringing American and British aviators and military men out of occupied Europe. So Dutch Paris was financed by the Allies to the extent of the 120 or so Allied military men that they helped.
Well, veteran radio listeners, we're talking to historian and author Megan Corman. She has a PhD and has taught European history at the University of Michigan and Texas Tech University, and has ridden the escape line. And it's a great story about sort of how ordinary people rise up and do heroic and historic activity in just a brutal war. Megan, how can people find the book and find more about you and what's going on relative to this piece of Western European history?
Well, I have a blog that I've been keeping for quite some time now. It's www.dutchparisblog.com, all one word. And it has a lot of short little stories about the resistance and about my research. And then, of course, there's the book, which is available from Oxford University Press or wherever you buy your books. It's also available as an e-book.
And we want to encourage people to go to the blog. You'll see there are a number of events where Megan is speaking around the country, in California, certainly in the Midwest. And I think if she's in your area, you want to go hear this story. You weren't taught it in history class. You'll be fascinated by, again, what some really extraordinary but ordinary people have done to help others during World War II and the Nazi persecution. Megan, thanks for taking some time to talk with Veterans Radio listeners today.
Well, thank you very much. I'm always happy to share this story because, as you say, it's inspiring.
It really is, and we don't hear enough of these sort of things. We get lost sometimes in the big picture without realizing all of these individual stories that are inside these larger military stories that we hear about.
That's right.
Thanks again.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.